treacherous time, the tail end of winter, spring not yet here. But if we wait longer, we will not find the nomads before they start on their migration. They ask no questions. To the girl I say simply, I am taking you back to your people, or as near as I can, seeing that they are now dispersed. She gives no sign of rejoicing. I lay at her side the heavy fur I have bought her to travel in, with a rabbit skin cap embroidered in the native fashion, new boots, gloves. Now that I have committed myself to a course, I sleep more easily, and even detect within myself something like happiness. We depart on the 3rd of March, accompanied through the gate and down the road to the lakeside by a ragtag escort of children and dogs. After we pass the irrigation wall and branch off from the river road, taking the track to the right, used by no one but hunters and fowlers, our escort begins to dwindle till there are only two stubborn lads trotting behind us, each determined to outlast the other. The sun has risen, but gives off no warmth. The wind beats at us across the lake, bringing tears to our eyes. In single file, four men and a woman, four pack animals, the horses persistently backing to the wind and having to be soared around, we wind away from the walled town, the bare fields, and eventually from the panting boys. My plan is to follow this track till we have skirted the lake to the south, then to strike out northeast across the desert, towards the valleys of the ranges where the northern nomads winter. It is a route rarely traveled, since the nomads, when they migrate with their flocks, follow the old dead riverbed in a vast sweep east and south. However, it reduces a journey of 6 weeks to one or two. I have never traveled it myself. So for the first 3 days we plod south and then eastward. To our right stretches a plain of wind-eroded clay terraces, merging at its extremes into banks of red dust clouds, and then into the yellow, hazy sky. To our left is flat marshland, belts of reeds, and the lake on which the central ice sheet has not melted. The wind blowing over the ice freezes our very breath, so that rather than ride, we often walk for long spells in the lee of our horses. The girl winds a scarf around and around her face, and crouching in the saddle, blindly follows her leader. Two of the pack horses are loaded with firewood, but this must be conserved for the desert. Once, half buried in drift sand, we come upon a spreading mound-like tamarisk, which we hack to pieces for fuel. For the rest, we have to be content with bundles of dry reeds. The girl and I sleep side by side in the same tent, huddled in our furs against the cold. In these early days of the journey, we eat well. We have brought salted meat, flour, beans, dried fruit, and there are wildfowl to shoot. But we have to be sparing with water. The marsh water here in the shallow southern fingers is too salty to be drinkable. One of the men has to wade 20 or 30 paces in, as deep as his calves, to fill the skins, or better, to break off lumps of ice. Yet even the melted ice water is so bitter and salty that it can only be drunk with strong red tea. Every year the lake grows more brackish, as the river eats into its banks and sweeps salt and alum into the lake. Since the lake has no outflow, its mineral content keeps rising, particularly in the south, where tracts of water are seasonally isolated by sandbars. After the summer flood, the fishermen find carp floating belly up in the shallows. They say that perch are no more to be seen. What will become of the settlement if the lake grows into a dead sea? After a day of salty tea, all of us except the girl begin to suffer from diarrhea. I am the worst afflicted. I feel keenly the humiliation of the frequent stops, the undressing and dressing with frozen fingers in the lee of a horse, while the others wait. I try to drink as little as possible, to the point even that my mind throws up tantalizing images as I ride. A full cask by the wellside, with water splashing from the ladle, clean snow. My occasional hunting and hawking, my desultory womanizing, exercises of manhood, have concealed from me how soft my body has grown. After long marches, my bones ache. By nightfall, I am so tired that I have no appetite. I trudge on till I cannot put one foot in front of the other. Then I clamber into the saddle, fold myself in my cloak, and wave one of the men forward to take over the task of picking out the faint track. The wind never lets up. It howls at us across the ice, blowing from nowhere to nowhere, veiling the sky in a cloud of red dust. From the dust, there is no hiding. It penetrates our clothing, cakes our skin, sifts into the baggage. We eat with coated tongues, spitting often, our teeth grating. Dust rather than air becomes the medium in which we live. We swim through dust like fish through water. The girl does not complain. She eats well. She does not get sick. She sleeps soundly all night, clenched in a ball, in weather so cold I would hug a dog for comfort. She rides all day without a murmur. Once, glancing up, I see that she is riding asleep, her face as peaceful as a baby's. On the third day, the rim of the marshland begins to curve back towards the north, and we know that we have rounded the lake. We pitch camp early, and spend the last hours of light collecting every scrap of fuel we can, while the horses browse for the last time on the meager marsh grass. Then, at dawn on the fourth day, we begin the crossing of the ancient lake bed that stretches another 40 miles beyond the marshes. The terrain is more desolate than anything we have yet seen. Nothing grows on this salty lake floor, which in places buckles and pushes up in jagged crystalline hexagons a foot wide. There are dangers, too. Crossing an unusually smooth patch, the front horse suddenly plunges through the crust and sinks chest deep in foul green slime. The man who leads it standing a moment dumbstruck on thin air before he too splashes in. We struggle to haul them out, the salt crust splintering under the hooves of the flailing horse, the hole widening, a brackish stench everywhere. We have not left the lake behind, we now realize it stretches beneath us here, sometimes under a cover many feet deep, sometimes under a mere parchment of brittle salt. How long since the sun last shone on these dead waters? We light a fire on firmer ground to warm the shivering man and dry his clothes. He shakes his head.
I always heard, beware of the green patches. But I never saw this happen before, he says.
He is our guide, the one man among us who has traveled east of the lake. After this, we push our horses even harder, in a hurry to be off the dead lake, fearful of being lost in a fluid colder than ice, mineral, subterraneous, airless. We bow our heads and drive into the wind, our coats ballooning behind us, picking away over the jagged salt shards, avoiding the smooth ground. Through the river of dust that courses majestically across the sky, the sun glows like an orange, but warms nothing. When darkness falls, we batter the tent pegs into cracks in the rock-hard salt. We burn our firewood at an extravagant rate, and like sailors, pray for land. On the fifth day, we leave the lake floor behind and pass through a belt of smooth crystalline salt, which soon gives way to sand and stone. Everyone is heartened, even the horses, which during the crossing of the salt have had nothing but a few handfuls of linseed and a bucketful of brackish water. Their condition is visibly deteriorating. As for the men, they do not grumble. The fresh meat is giving out, but there remain the salt meat and dried beans, and plenty of flour and tea, the staples of the road. At each halt we brew tea and fry little fat cakes, delicious morsels to the hungry. The men do the cooking, being shy of the girl, unsure of her standing, unsure most of all what we are doing taking her to the barbarians. They barely address her, avoid looking at her, and certainly do not ask for her help with the food. I do not push her forward, hoping that constraint will disappear on the road. I picked these men because they were hardy and honest and willing. They follow me as light-heartedly as they can under these conditions. Though by now the brave, lacquered armor the two young soldiers wore when we passed through the great gate is strapped in bundles on the pack horses, and their scabbards are full of sand. The sand flats begin to modulate into dune land. Our progress slows as we toil up and down the sides of the dunes. It is the worst possible terrain for the horses, which plod forward a few inches at a time, their hooves sinking deep in the sand. I look to our guide, but all he can do is shrug.
It goes on for miles. We have to cross it. There is no other way.
Standing on a dune top, shielding my eyes, staring ahead, I can see nothing but swirling sand. That night, one of the pack horses refuses its feed. In the morning, even under the severest flogging, it will not rise. We redistribute the loads and cast away some of the firewood. While the others set out, I stay behind. I can swear that the beast knows what is to happen. At the sight of the knife, its eyes roll. With the blood spurting from its neck, it scrambles free of the sand and totters a pace or two downwind before it falls. In extremities, I have heard, the barbarians tap their horses' veins. Will we live to regret this blood spent so lavishly on the sand? On the seventh day, with the dunes finally behind us, we make out against the dull grey-brown of the empty landscape a strip of darker grey. From nearer, we see that it stretches east and west for miles. There are even the stunted black shapes of trees. We are lucky, our guide says. There is bound to be water here. What we have stumbled on is the bed of an ancient terminal lagoon. Dead reeds, ghostly white and brittle to the touch, line what were its banks. The trees are poplars, also long dead. They have died since the underground water receded too far to be reached by their roots, years and years ago. We unload the animals and begin to dig. At 2 feet we reach heavy blue clay. Beneath this there is sand again, then another stratum of clay, noticeably clammy. At a depth of 7 feet, with my heart pounding and my ears ringing, I have to refuse my turn with the spade. The three men toil on, lifting the loose soil out of the pit in a tent cloth tied at the corners. At 10 feet, water begins to gather around their feet. It is sweet. There is no trace of salt. We smile with delight at each other, but it gathers very slowly, and the sides of the pit have continually to be dug out as they cave in. It is only by late afternoon that we can empty out the last of our brackish lake water and refill the water skins. In near dark, we lower the butt into our well and allow the horses to drink. Meanwhile, now that there is an abundance of poplar wood, the men have dug 2 little ovens back to back in the clay and built a roaring fire on top of them to bake the clay dry. When the fire abates, they can rake the coals back into the ovens and set about baking bread. The girl stands watching all this, leaning on her sticks to which I have fastened discs of wood to help her in the sand. In the free and easy camaraderie of this good day, and with a day of rest promised, talk flows. Joking with her, the men make their first overture of friendship.
Come and sit with us and taste what men's baking is like.
She smiles back at them, lifting her chin in a gesture which perhaps I alone know is an effort to see. Cautiously, she sets herself down beside them to bathe in the glow from the ovens. I myself sit further away, sheltered from the wind in the mouth of my tent with one of the oil lamps flickering beside me, making the day's entry in the logbook, but listening too. The banter goes on in the Pigeon of the Frontier, and she is at no loss for words. I'm surprised by her fluency, her quickness, her self-possession. I even catch myself in a flush of pride. She is not just the old man's slut. She is a witty, attractive young woman. Perhaps if from the beginning I had known how to use this slap-happy joking lingo with her, we might have warmed more to each other. But like a fool, instead of giving her a good time, I oppressed her with gloom. Truly, the world ought to belong to the singers and dancers. Futile bitterness, idle melancholy, empty regrets. I blow out the lamp, sit with my chin on my fist, staring towards the fire, listening to my stomach rumble. I sleep a sleep of utter exhaustion. I barely emerge into wakefulness when she lifts the edge of the huge bear fur and snuggles against me. A child gets cold in the night. That is what I think in my befuddlement, hauling her into the crook of my arm, dozing away. Perhaps for a while I am fast asleep again. Then, wide awake, I feel her hand groping under my clothes, her tongue licking my ear. A ripple of sensual joy runs through me. I yawn, stretch, and smile in the dark. Her hand finds what it is seeking. What of it? I think. What if we perish in the middle of nowhere? Let us at least not die pinched and miserable. Beneath her smock, she is bare. With a heave, I am upon her. She is warm, swollen, ready for me. In a minute, 5 months of senseless hesitancy are wiped out, and I am floating back into easy, sensual oblivion. When I wake, it is with a mind washed so blank that terror rises in me. Only with a deliberate effort can I reinsert myself into time and space, into a bed, a tent, a night, a world, a body pointing west and east. Though I lie sprawled on her with the weight of a dead ox, the girl is asleep, her arms clasped slackly around my back. I ease myself off her, rearrange our covering, and try to compose myself. Not for an instant do I imagine that I can strike camp on the morrow, march back to the oasis, and in the magistrate's sunny villa set about living out my days with a young bride, sleeping placidly by her side, fathering her children, watching the seasons turn. I do not shy at the thought that if she had not spent the evening with the young men around the campfire, she would very likely not have found any need for me. Perhaps the truth is that it was one of them she was embracing when I held her in my arms. I listen scrupulously to the reverberations of that thought inside me, but cannot detect a plunging of the heart to tell me I am injured. She sleeps. My hand passes back and forth over her smooth belly, caresses her thighs. It is done. I am content. At the same time, I am ready to believe that it would not have been done if I were not in a few days to part from her. Nor, if I must be candid, does the pleasure I take in her, the pleasure whose distant afterglow my palm still feels, go deep. No more than before does my heart leap, or my blood pound at her touch. I am with her not for whatever raptures she may promise or yield, but for other reasons. which remain as obscure to me as ever. Except that it has not escaped me that in bed, in the dark, the marks her torturers have left upon her, the twisted feet, the half-blind eyes, are easily forgotten. Is it then the case that it is the whole woman I want? That my pleasure in her is spoiled until these marks on her are erased and she is restored to herself? Or is it the case, I am not stupid, let me say these things, that it is the marks on her which drew me to her, but which, to my disappointment, I find do not go deep enough? Too much or too little? Is it she I want? Or the traces of a history her body bears? For a long time I lie staring into what seems pitch blackness, though I know the roof of the tent is only an arm's length away. No thought that I think, no articulation, however antonymic, of the origin of my desire seems to upset me. I must be tired, I think. Or perhaps whatever can be articulated is falsely put. My lips move, silently composing and recomposing the words. Or perhaps it is the case that only that which has not been articulated has to be lived through. I stare at this last proposition without detecting any answering movement in myself toward assent or dissent. The words grow more and more opaque before me. Soon they have lost all meaning. I sigh at the end of a long day, in the middle of a long night. Then I turn to the girl, embrace her, draw her tight against me. She purrs in her sleep, where soon I have joined her. We rest on the eighth day, for the horses are now in a truly pitiable state. They chew hungrily at the sapless fibre of the dead reed stalks. They bloat their bellies with water and break wind massively. We have fed them the last of the linseed and even a little of our bread. Unless we find grazing in a day or two, they will perish. We leave our well behind us and the mound of earth we dug to press on northwards. All of us walk except the girl. We have abandoned whatever we can afford to lighten the horse's burden, but since we cannot survive without fire, they must still carry bulky loads of wood. When will we see the mountains? I ask our guide.
One day, 2 days, it is hard to say. I have not traveled these parts before.
He has hunted along the eastern shore of the lake and the periphery of the desert without having reason to cross it. I wait, giving him every chance to speak his mind. But he seems unperturbed. He does not believe we are in danger.
Perhaps 2 days before we see the mountains, then another day's march before we reach them.
He screws up his eyes, peering into the brown haze that veils the horizon. He does not ask what we will do when we get to the mountains. We reach the end of this flat, pebbly waste and ascend a series of rocky ridges to a low plateau, where we begin to meet with hummocks of withered winter grass. The animals tear savagely at them. It is a great relief to see them eat. I wake up with a start in the middle of the night, filled with a dire sense that something is wrong. The girl sits up beside me.
What is it?
She says.
Listen, the wind has stopped.
Barefoot, wrapped in a fur, she crawls after me out of the tent. It is snowing gently. The earth lies white on every side beneath a hazy full moon. I help her to her feet and stand holding her, staring up into the void from which the snowflakes descend, in a silence that is palpable after a week of wind beating ceaselessly in our ears. The men from the second tent join us. We smile foolishly at each other. Spring snow, I say. The last snow of the year. They nod. A horse, shaking itself off nearby, startles us. In the snowbound warmth of the tent, I make love to her again. She is passive, accommodating herself to me. When we begin, I am sure that the time is right. I embrace her in the most intense pleasure and pride of life. But halfway through, I seem to lose touch with her, and the act peters out vacantly. My intuitions are clearly fallible. Still, my heart continues its affectionate glow towards this girl, who so briskly falls asleep in the crook of my arm. There will be another time, and if not, I do not think I mind. A voice is calling through the slit of the tent mouth.
Sir, you must wake up!
I am dazedly aware of having overslept. It is the stillness, I think to myself. It is as if we are becalmed in the stillness. I emerge from the tent into daylight.
Look, sir,
says the man who woke me, pointing northeast.
Bad weather on the way.
Rolling down upon us over the snowy plain is a gigantic black wave. It is still miles away, but visibly devouring the earth in its approach. Its crest is lost in the murky clouds.
A storm!
I shout. I have never seen anything so frightening. The men hurry to take down their tent.
Bring the horses in. Tether them here in the center.
The first gusts are already reaching us. The snow begins to eddy and fly. The girl is beside me on her sticks.
Can you see it?
I say. She peers in her crooked way and nods. The men set to work striking the second tent. The snow was not a good sign, after all. She does not reply. Though I know I should be helping, I cannot tear my eyes from the great black wall, roaring down upon us with the speed of a galloping horse. The wind rises, rocking us on our feet. The familiar howl is in our ears again. I bestir myself.
Quick! Quick!
I call out, clapping my hands. One man is on his knees folding the tent cloths, rolling the felts, stowing the bedclothes. The other two are bringing the horses in.
Sit down,
I shout to the girl, and scramble to help with the packing. The storm wall is not black anymore, but a chaos of whirling sand and snow and dust. Then all at once the wind rises to a scream. My cap is whirled from my head and the storm hits us. I am knocked flat on my back. Not by the wind, but by a horse that breaks free and blunders about, ears flat, eyes rolling.
Catch it!
I shout. My words are nothing but a whisper. I cannot hear them myself. The horse vanishes from sight like a phantom. At the same instant, the tent is whirled high into the sky. I hurl myself upon the bundled felts, holding them down, groaning with fury at myself. Then on hands and feet, dragging the felts, I inch my way back towards the girl. It is like crawling against running water. My eyes, my nose, my mouth are already stopped with sand. I heave to breathe. The girl stands with her arms stretched like wings over the necks of two horses. She seems to be talking to them. Though their eyeballs glare, they are still.
Our tent is gone!
I shout in her ear, waving an arm toward the sky. She turns. Beneath the cap, her face is wrapped in a black scarf. Even her eyes are covered.
Tent is gone!
I shout again. She nods. For 5 hours, we huddle behind the piled firewood and the horses, while the wind lashes us with snow, ice, rain, sand, grit. We ache with cold to our very bones. The flanks of the horses turned to the wind are caked with ice. We press together, man and beast, sharing our warmth, trying to endure. Then at midday, the wind drops as suddenly as if a gate has been closed somewhere. Our ears ring in the unfamiliar quiet. We ought to move our numbed limbs, clean ourselves off, load the animals, anything to make the blood run in our veins. But all we want is to lie a little longer in our nest. A sinister lethargy. My voice rasps from my throat.
Come!
Come, men, let us load.
Humps in the sand show where our discarded baggage lies buried. We search downwind but find no sign of the lost tent. We help the creaking horses up and load them. The cold of the tempest is as nothing to the cold that succeeds it, settling like a pall of ice upon us. Our breath turns to rime. We shiver in our boots. After three unsteady seesawing steps, the front horse crumples on its hindquarters. We throw aside the firewood it carries, lift it to its feet with a pole, whip it on. I curse myself, not for the first time, for setting out on a hard journey, with an unsure guide in a treacherous season. The 10th day. Warmer air, clearer skies, a gentler wind. We are plodding on across the flatlands when our guide shouts and points. The mountains, I think, and my heart leaps. But it is not the mountains he sees. The specks he points to in the distance are men, men on horseback. Who but barbarians? I turn to the girl whose shambling mount I lead. We are nearly there, I say. There are people ahead. We will soon know who they are. The oppression of the past days lifts from my shoulders. Moving to the front, quickening my pace, I turn our march towards the three tiny figures in the distance. We push on towards them for half an hour before we realize that we are getting no closer. As we move, they move too. They are ignoring us, I think, and consider lighting a fire. But when I call a halt, the three specks seem to halt too. When we resume our march, they begin to move. Are they reflections of us? Is this a trick of the light? I wonder. We cannot close the gap. How long have they been dogging us? Or do they think we are dogging them? Stop! There is no point in chasing them, I say to the men. Let us see if they will meet one of us alone. So I mount the girl's horse and ride out alone towards the strangers. For a short while they seem to remain still, watching and waiting. Then they begin to recede, shimmering on the edge of the dust haze. Though I urge it on, my horse is too weak to raise more than a shambling trot. I give up the chase, dismount, and wait for my companions to reach me. To conserve the horse's strength, we have been making our marches shorter and shorter. We traveled no more than 6 miles that afternoon across firm, flat terrain. The three horsemen ahead of us, hovering always within eyesight, before we make camp. The horses have an hour to graze on what stunted scrub grass they can find. Then we tether them close to the tent and set a watch. Night falls. The stars come out in a hazy sky. We lounge about the campfire, basking in the warmth, savoring the ache of tired limbs, reluctant to crowd into the single tent. Staring north, I can swear that I glimpse the flicker of another fire. But when I try to point it out to the others, the night is impenetrably black. The three men volunteer to sleep outside, taking turns with the watch. I am touched. In a few days, I say. When it is warmer. We sleep fitfully, four bodies crammed together in a tent meant for two, the girl modestly outermost. I am up before dawn staring northward. As the pinks and mauves of the sunrise begin to turn golden, the specks materialize again on the blank face of the plain. Not three of them, but 8, 9, 10, perhaps 12. With a pole and a white linen shirt, I make a banner and ride out towards the strangers. The wind has dropped. The air is clear. I count as I ride, 12 tiny figures on the side of a rise. And far behind them, the faintest, ghostly intimation of the blue of the mountains. Then as I watch, the figures begin to move. They group in a file and like ants climb the rise. On the crest, they halt. A swirl of dust obscures them. Then they reappear, 12 mounted men on the skyline. I plod on, the white banner flapping over my shoulder. Though I keep my eye on the crest, I fail to catch the moment at which they vanish. We must simply ignore them, I tell my party. We reload and resume our march towards the mountains. Though the loads grow lighter every day, it hurts our hearts to have to flog the emaciated animals on. The girl is bleeding. That time of the month has come for her. She cannot conceal it. She has no privacy. There is not the merest bush to hide behind. She is upset, and the men are upset. It is the old story. A woman's flux is bad luck, bad for the crops, bad for the hunt, bad for the horses. They grow sullen. They want her away from the horses, which cannot be. They do not want her to touch their food. Ashamed, she keeps to herself all day and does not join us for the evening meal. After I have eaten, I take a bowl of beans and dumplings to the tent where she sits.
You should not be waiting on me, she says. I should not even be in the tent, but there is nowhere else to go.
She does not question her exclusion. Never mind, I tell her. I touch my hand to her cheek, sit down for a while, and watch her eat. It is futile to press the men to sleep in the tent with her. They sleep outside, keeping the fire burning, rotating the watch. In the morning, for their sake, I go through a brief purification ceremony with the girl, for I have made myself unclean by sleeping in her bed. With a stick, I draw a line in the sand, lead her across it, wash her hands and mine, then lead her back across the line into the camp.
You will have to do the same again tomorrow morning, she murmurs.
In 12 days on the road, we have grown closer than in months of living in the same rooms. We have reached the foothills. The strange horsemen plod on far ahead of us, up the winding bed of a dry stream. We have ceased trying to catch up with them. We understand now that while they are following us, they are also leading us. As the terrain grows rockier, we progress more and more slowly. When we halt to rest or lose sight of the strangers in the windings of the stream, it is without fear of their vanishing. Then, climbing a ridge, coaxing the horses, straining and pushing and hauling, we are all of a sudden upon them. From behind the rocks, from out of a hidden gully, they emerge. Men mounted on shaggy ponies, 12 and more, dressed in sheepskin coats and caps, brown-faced, weather-beaten, narrow-eyed, the barbarians in the flesh, on native soil. I am close enough to smell them where I stand, horse sweat, smoke, half-cured leather. One of them points at my chest, an ancient musket nearly as long as a man, with a bipod rest bolted near the muzzle. My heart stops. No, I whisper. With elaborate caution, I drop the reins of the horse I am leading and display empty hands. As slowly, I turn my back, take up the reins, and slipping and sliding on the scree, lead the horse the 30 paces down to the foot of the ridge where my companions wait. The barbarians stand outlined against the sky above us. There is the beating of my heart, the heaving of the horses, the moan of the wind, and no other sound. We have crossed the limits of the empire. It is not a moment to take lightly. I help the girl from her horse. Listen carefully, I say. I will take you up the slope and you can speak to them. Bring your sticks. The ground is loose. There is no other way up. When you have spoken, you can decide what you want to do. If you want to go with them, if they will see you back to your family, go with them. If you decide to come back with us, you can come back with us. Do you understand? I am not forcing you. She nods. She is very nervous. With an arm around her, I help her up the pebbly slope. The barbarians do not stir. I count 3 of the long-barreled muskets. Otherwise, they bear the short bows I am familiar with. As they reach the crest, they back away slightly. Can you see them? I say, panting. She turns her head in that odd, unmotivated way.
Not well,
she says. Blind. What is the word for blind? She tells me. I address the barbarians. Blind, I say, touching my eyelids. They make no response. The gun resting between the pony's ears still points at me. Its owner's eyes glint merrily. The silence lengthens.
Speak to them,
I tell her. Tell them why we are here. Tell them your story. Tell them the truth. She looks sideways at me and gives a little smile.
You really want me to tell them the truth?
Tell them the truth. What else is there to tell? The smile does not leave her lips. She shakes her head, keeps her silence. Tell them what you like. Only now that I have brought you back as far as I can, I wish to ask you very clearly to return to the town with me. Of your own choice. I grip her arm. Do you understand me?
That is what I want. Why?
The word falls with deathly softness from her lips. She knows that it confounds me, has confounded me from the beginning. The man with the gun advances slowly until he is almost upon us. She shakes her head.
No. I do not want to go back to that place.
I scramble down the slope. Light a fire, brew tea, we will stop here, I tell the men. From above, the soft cascade of the girl's speech reaches me broken by the gusting of the wind. She leans on her two sticks, the horsemen dismounting and clustering around her. I cannot make out a word. What a waste, I think. She could have spent those long, empty evenings teaching me her tongue. Too late now. From my saddlebag, I bring out the two silver platters I have carried across the desert. I take the bolt of silk out of its wrapping. I would like you to have these, I say. I guide her hand so that she can feel the softness of the silk, the chasing on the platters. Fishes and leaves interlaced. I have also brought her little bundle. What it contains, I do not know. I lay it on the ground. Will they take you all the way? She nods.
He says by midsummer. He says he wants a horse too, for me.
Tell him we have a long, hard road before us. Our horses are in a bad way, as he can see for himself. Ask if we cannot buy horses from them instead. Say we will pay in silver. She interprets to the old man while I wait. His companions have dismounted, but he still sits his horse, the enormous old gun on its strap over his back. Stirrups, saddle, bridle, reins, no metal, but bone and fire-hardened wood sewn with gut, lashed with thongs. Bodies clothed in wool and the hides of animals and nourished from infancy on meat and milk, foreign to the suave touch of cotton, the virtues of the placid grains and fruits. These are the people being pushed off the plains into the mountains by the spread of empire. I have never before met northerners on their own ground, on equal terms. The barbarians I am familiar with are those who visit the oasis to barter, and the few who make their camp along the river, and Joel's miserable captives. What an occasion, and what a shame, too, to be here today. One day my successors will be making collections of the artifacts of these people, arrowheads, carved knife handles, wooden dishes, to display beside my birds' eggs and calligraphic riddles. And here I am, patching up relations between the men of the future and the men of the past, returning with apologies, a body we have sucked dry, a go-between, a jackal of empire in sheep's clothing.
He says no.
I take one of the little silver bars from my bag and hold it up to him. Say this is for one horse. He leans down, takes the glittering bar, and carefully bites it. Then it disappears into his coat.
He says no. The silver is for the horse he does not take. He does not take my horse. He takes the silver instead.
I almost lose my temper. But what good will haggling do? She is going. She is almost gone. This is the last time to look on her clearly face to face, to scrutinize the motions of my heart, to try to understand who she really is. Hereafter, I know I will begin to reform her out of my repertoire of memories, according to my questionable desires. I touch her cheek, take her hand. On this bleak hillside in mid-morning, I can find no trace in myself of that stupefied eroticism that used to draw me night after night to her body, or even of the comradely affection of the road. There is only a blankness, and desolation that there has to be such blankness. When I tighten my grip on her hand, there is no answer. I see only too clearly what I see. A stocky girl with a broad mouth and hair cut in a fringe across her forehead, staring over my shoulder into the sky. A stranger, a visitor from strange parts, now on her way home after a less than happy visit.
Goodbye,
I say.
Goodbye,
she says. There is no more life in her voice than in mine. I begin to climb down the slope. By the time I reach the bottom, they have taken the sticks from her and are helping her onto a pony. As far as one can ever be sure, spring has come. The air is balmy. The green tips of new grass shoots are beginning to push out here and there. Flurries of desert quail chase before us. If we had left the oasis now rather than 2 weeks ago, we would have traveled faster and not have risked our lives. On the other hand, would we have been lucky enough to find the barbarians? This very day I am sure they are folding their tents, packing their carts, bringing their flocks under the whip for the spring migrations. I was not wrong to take the risk, though I know the men blame me.
Bringing us out here in winter,
I imagine them saying.
We should never have agreed.
And what must they think now that they realize they were not part of an embassy to the barbarians, as I hinted, but simply an escort for a woman, a leftover barbarian prisoner, a person of no account, the magistrate's slut. We try to retrace our old route as closely as possible, relying on the star sightings I have been careful to plot. The wind is behind us, the weather is warmer, the horses' loads are lighter. We know where we are. There is no reason why we should not travel fast. But at the first night's stop, there is a setback. I am called to the campfire where one of the young soldiers sits dejectedly, with his face in his hands. His boots are off, his footcloths unwrapped.
Look at his foot, sir,
says our guide. The right foot is puffy and inflamed. What is wrong? I ask the boy. He lifts the foot and shows me a heel caked with blood and pus. Even above the smell of dirty footcloths, I detect a putrid odor.
How long has your foot been like this?
I shout. He hides his face.
Why did you not say anything? Didn't I tell you all that you must keep your feet clean? That you must change your footcloths every second day and wash them? That you must put ointment on blisters and bandage them? I gave those orders for a reason. How are you going to travel with your foot in that condition?
The boy does not reply.
He did not want to hold us up, his friend whispers. He did not want to hold us up, but now we have to cart him all the way back,
I shout.
Boil water. See that he cleans his foot and bandages it.
I am right. When next morning they tried to help him on with his boot, he cannot hide his agony. With the bandaged foot wound in a bag and tied, he can limp along over the easier ground, but for the most part, he has to ride. We will all be happy when this journey is over. We are tired of each other's company, On the fourth day, we strike the bed of the Dead Lagoon and follow it southeast for several miles before we reach our old waterhole with its clump of stark poplar trunks. There we rest for a day, gathering our strength for the hardest stretch. We fry a supply of fat cakes and boil the last potful of beans to a mash. I keep to myself. The men talk in low voices and fall into silence when I am near. All the earlier excitement has gone out of the expedition, not only because its climax has been so disappointing, a palaver in the desert followed by the same road back, but because the presence of the girl had spurred the men into sexual display, into a brotherly rivalry, which has now declined into morose irritability, directed willy-nilly against me for taking them on a foolhardy jaunt, against the horses for their recalcitrance, against their fellow with the sore foot for holding them up, against the brute impedimenta they have to carry, even against themselves. I set an example by laying out my bedroll beside the fire beneath the stars, preferring the cold of the open air to the choking warmth of a tent with three disgruntled men. The next night, no one offers to pitch the tent, and we all sleep outside. By the seventh day, we are making our way through the salt wastes. We lose another horse. The men, tired of the monotonous beans and flour cakes, ask to slaughter it for food. I give my permission, but do not join in. "I will go on ahead with the horses," I say. "Let them enjoy their feast. Let me not hinder them from imagining it is my throat they cut, my bowels they tear out, my bones they crack. Perhaps they will be friendlier afterwards." I think with yearning of the familiar routine of my duties, of the approaching summer, the long dreamy siestas, conversations with friends at dusk under the walnut trees, with boys bringing tea and lemonade, and the eligible girls in twos and threes promenading before us on the square in their finery. Only days since I parted from that other one, and I find her face hardening over in my memory, becoming opaque, impermeable, as though secreting a shell over itself. Plodding across the salt, I catch myself in a moment of astonishment that I could have loved someone from so remote a kingdom. All I want now is to live out my life in ease in a familiar world, to die in my own bed, and be followed to the grave by old friends. From as far away as 10 miles, we can make out the jutting watchtowers against the sky. While we are still on the track south of the lake, the ochre of the walls begins to separate out from the gray of the desert background. I glance at the men behind me. Their step, too, has quickened. They can barely hide their excitement. We have not bathed or changed our clothes in 3 weeks. We stink, our skin is dry, and seamed in black from the beating of wind and sun. We are exhausted. But we walk like men. Even the boy who stumps along now on his bandaged foot, with his chest thrown out. It could have been worse. It could have been better, perhaps, but it could have been worse. Even the horses, their bellies bloated with marsh grass, seem restored to life. In the fields, the first spring shoots are beginning to show. The thin tones of a trumpet reach our ears. The horsemen of the welcoming party issue from the gates, the sun flashing on their helmets. We look like scarecrows. It would have been better if I had told the men to put on their armor for these last few miles. I watch the horsemen trot towards us, expecting them at any moment to break into a gallop, to fire off their guns in the air and shout. But their demeanor remains businesslike. They are not a welcoming party at all, I begin to realize. There are no children running after them. They divide in two and surround us. There is not one face among them that I recognize. Their eyes are stony. They do not answer my questions, but march us back like prisoners through the open gates. It is only when we emerge onto the square and see the tents and hear the hubbub, that we understand. The army is here. The promised campaign against the barbarians is underway. 4. A man sits at my desk in the office behind the courtroom. I have never seen him before, but the insignia on his lilac-blue tunic tell me that he belongs to the 3rd Bureau of the Civil Guard. A pile of brown folders tied with pink tapes lies at his elbow. One is open before him. I recognize the folders. They contain records of taxes and levies dating back 50 years. Can he really be examining them? What is he looking for? I speak. Is there anything I can help you with? He ignores me, and the two stiff soldiers who guard me might as well be made of wood. I am far from complaining. After my weeks in the desert, it is no hardship to stand idle. Besides, I sense a faraway tinge of exultation at the prospect that the false friendship between myself and the Bureau may be coming to an end. May I speak to Colonel Jol? I say. A shot in the dark. Who is to say that Jol has returned? He does not answer, continuing his pretense of reading the documents. He is a good-looking man, with regular white teeth and lovely blue eyes. But vain, I think. I picture him sitting up in bed beside a girl, flexing his muscles for her, feeding on her admiration. The kind of man who drives his body like a machine, I imagine. Ignorant that it has its own rhythms. When he looks at me, as he will in a moment, he will look from behind that handsome, immobile face and through those clear eyes as an actor looks from behind a mask. He looks up from the page. It is just as I thought. Where have you been? He says. I have been away on a long journey. It pains me that I was not here when you arrived to offer you hospitality. But now I am back, and all that is mine is yours. His insignia say that he is a warrant officer. Warrant officer in the 3rd Bureau. What does that mean? At a guess, 5 years of kicking and beating people, contempt for the regular police and for due process of law. A detestation of smooth patrician talk like mine. But perhaps I do him an injustice. I have been away from the capital for a long time. You have been treasonously consorting with the enemy, he says. So it is out. Treasonously consorting, a phrase out of a book. We are at peace here, I say. We have no enemies. There is silence. Unless I make a mistake, I say. Unless we are the enemy. I am not sure that he understands me. The natives are at war with us, he says. I doubt that he has ever set eyes on a barbarian in his life. Why have you been consorting with them? Who gave you permission to leave your post? I shrug off the problem.